Great. Okay. Wonderful. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the monthly meeting of the Sufi Studies Network. My name is Neira Salibegovic. I'll be hosting today's wonderful talk, which we're really looking forward to. But to begin, I just would like to start with an acknowledgement of country. So I'm speaking from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Eastern Kulin Nation. I want to pay my respect to elders past, present and emerging, and extend my respect to any Aboriginal people present here today. Sovereignty was never ceded. So for today's talk, I have the great privilege of welcoming Dr. Banu Shenoy and Professor Christopher Houston. So I'll just give a brief bio of our two speakers. It'll be a 30 minutes talk approximately, followed by 20 minutes Q&A. So Banu Shenoy is a social anthropologist by training. Currently, she is a senior lecturer in anthropology at the School of Social Sciences, Macquarie University, Sydney. Her work engages with the fields of state-diaspora relations, citizenship practices, and the creative sonic visual traditions of Islam. Currently, she is working on two Turkey-based projects. Her Australian Research Council-funded project with Professor Julian Milley from Monash investigates the Islamic bureaucratic organ of the Turkish state through an exploration of the state-sponsored educational field. Her second project with Chris Houston directly engages with citizens' skilled engagement with Ottoman entities in the urban landscape of Istanbul, a project that engages with debates in anthropology around skilled learning, ethics, and Islamic cultural politics. She is the author of two books, Beyond Turkey's Borders, Long Distance Kemalism, State Politics and the Turkish Diaspora, published in 2013, and Musical Ethics and Islam, published in 2020. Christopher Houston is a professor of anthropology at Macquarie University, Sydney. He has carried out extensive fieldwork in Turkey on Islamic social movements, nationalism, urban processes in Istanbul, political activists, conscientious objection, and on the Kurdish issue. His recent books include Istanbul, City of the Fearless, Urban Activism, Coup d'État, and Memory in Turkey, published in 2020 by the University of California Press, and Theocracy, Secularism, and Islam in Turkey, Anthropocratic Republic, published in 2021 by Palgrave Macmillan. A new volume in 2023, co-edited with Jean-Paul Baldacchino and published by Rutgers University Press, is titled Self-Alteration: How People Change Themselves Across Cultures. Thank you so much. Over to you too.
Thanks, Nejra. Oh, let me bring up the slides.
Thanks, Nejra. Great. Okay, so I'm hoping that everyone can hear me clear enough. Great, thank you. So Nejra, thanks for that introduction. And as you can see, what we thought we'd do for the talk is that Banu will share her screen and we'll click on the slides at the appropriate points, and I'll sort of read out the paper, partly because I'm a bit of a technological illiterate. And I thought it might be beyond my capacities to be clicking on and reading at the same time. Not really, but anyway, that's how we've decided to do it. Okay, so I'll just briefly begin with this interesting quote from Ahmet Hamdi Tanpınar from the book Five Cities, around Istanbul, Bursa, some other cities, and in his visits to them. And the quote is, "Let objects be. Let them inaugurate the reign of beauty within us." And I hope the relevance of the quote will become clearer as I sort of move through the paper. So let me begin. Walking around Ayazma Cami in Doğancılar, Üsküdar, high on its hill on a mild autumn day, we bump into another wanderer. He is looking at the Ottoman graves in their small square plot, with their worn markings and sculptured stone tributes to those who once lived. He tells us that after Sultan Mahmud II massacred the Janissaries, he also ordered the desecration of their graves by the cutting off of their distinctive headpieces. For unknown reasons, two graves in Ayazma Jami escaped this architectural retribution. The only ones in Istanbul, their sculptured stone headdresses, a crested cap with a hanging fold behind, known as the sleeve of Haji Bektash, are still on the tombstones. Ahmet shows us the small carved stone birdhouses attached to Ayazma's walls. Centuries later, birds flit in and out of their holes. Together, we marvel at the hospitality they receive from their miniature medrese, designed with tiny Islamic cupolas, latticed windows, minarets, and domes crowned with crescents. Islamic homes for Muslim birds. So to those who notice, Ayazma Jami is a place that reveals both intra-Ottoman fratricide and interspecies intimacy. Ahmet tells us that he explores Istanbul's historical places every weekend. But in doing so, he is neither an exception nor alone. Indeed, he is part, what appears to us, he is part of a great mass of local denizens learning to appreciate Ottoman entities so as to freshly experience, understand, and revaluate their living in an ex-Ottoman city. Through a diverse range of overlapping strategies and practices, this diverse group of lay people desire to craft an altered present for themselves by establishing new relationships with the works created by previous generations. So our brief talk today is about these people and the methods they use to contact Ottoman objects so as to alter their own perceptions of the city. Who are these people? What is the political context of their actions? What are these Ottoman objects? And through which activities do people access and perceive them, constituting for themselves a particular sensual Istanbul? And how do the alluring qualities of Ottoman objects themselves contribute to people's perception of them, even as their reality transcends their effects on users? So these questions are central, we think, to a book manuscript that we're just beginning to work on, provisionally titled Hiding in Plain Sight, Ottoman Objects and the Reperceiving of Istanbul. The book explores the way different people engage with particular Ottoman objects in Istanbul, as well as how those things themselves both welcome and rebuff such interactions. These entities include, really importantly, that we're not going to talk about it today actually, include Ottoman Islamic art practices in particular and artworks, but also Ottoman built environments, particularly mosque complexes or kulya, fountains, cemeteries, Sufi tekkes and tombs, also Ottoman calligraphic writings or kitabe inscribed all over the city, and finally, but also rich sources of poetry and narrative history composed about Istanbul. And I think that rather than conceiving this as a study of the politics of memory per se, actually we're preferring to take an actor-centered approach that seeks to study the emergence of a new existential consciousness generated in Istanbul's denizens by the city's dynamic objects. And for ourselves, in learning to develop progressively more intimate connections with Ottoman objects from and also alongside our interlocutors, we too think that over time we will or have become altered by these encounters. So in the bigger project, there's a sort of an autoethnographic dimension to this study of object perception. Okay, so first question, in what ways do people relate to these Ottoman entities? As noted at Ayazma, people range across the city, making public places personal, discovering their own favored perspectives in being there, and appreciating the exquisite assemblages and qualities of stone, tile, brick, lettering, paint, colour, and design that constitute each site as its unique self, exploring Ottoman buildings and environments so as to receive their blessings and to modify one's own attitudes towards one's own life and times is highly valued. In this trans-neighborhood visitation practice, people living in newer suburbs with their own more recent vital political and social histories supplement their lives there by transforming other parts of the city into familiar environments, making them too personal places of I can, the Merleau-Pontian phrase, that we don't live in the world necessarily theoretically in perception, we actually live in a world directed around to what we can do in it. So it's the I can aspect of living in a place. Extending their stewardship over the city, people use its Ottoman nooks and crannies for their own delight. Equally esteemed are expeditions to Istanbul cemeteries. I think we might click on, and to the graves of people picked out as significant figures for visitants. Graves are fragile, and their susceptibility to the vagaries of weather, living beings, mold, worms, water, etc., and political distinction enable visitors to puzzle over the precariousness of love, kinship, and renown. Yet graves can be generative too. The grave of 16th century Ottoman calligrapher Sheikh Hamdullah in Karaca Ahmet Cemetery in Üsküdar has magnetized other calligraphers to be buried there alongside it. A speaker at a seminar we attended on the now demolished Halaç Baba Sufi convent, that's the one on the right-hand side there, noted that many people feel a peace and a comfort in places where what he calls spiritually beloved souls, in Turkish said manevi sahipleri, are buried, sensing a bond or a contact with the dead and finding scope for self-knowledge. He finished his talk by recounting a story about Ibn Arabi, who asked a friend from Tunisia why he'd like to visit a particular cemetery in Cairo. "There I can hear my heart," his friend replied. "Kalbimi burada duyuyorum." So another strategy, learning to read the difficult Ottoman script and language is popular, so as to attend to and to decipher the gnomic written messages, the kitabe, hiding in plain sight all over the city. Jeremy Walton argues that in post-imperial cities like Istanbul, certain sites, he particularly thinks museums, but we could say certain sites such as monuments as well, simultaneously enact a spatial proximity for people, while paradoxically deepening a fissure for people between the present and the past. We think that learning to read the Ottoman Turkish inscribed on buildings, mosques, fountains, etc., all over the historic city is a way of bridging that fissure, visited upon generations of Swiss city dwellers by the Republican alphabet reform. In learning to read Ottoman, readers receive meanings from calligraphic writings, changing them from scribbles upon a flat plane to repositories of sense, and finally, to revelations of aesthetic skill of the calligrapher. People have told us about their favorite kitabe, about messages or statements that reveal wisdom, or as they appreciate the calligraphic skills involved in them, make them feel closer to their particular makers. Selim, for example, explains that he loves drinking tea in Kara Mustafa Pasha Cami in Karaköy, next to, or just as you can see, below where the Kelime Tevhid is written. Another friend reports that he changes his way. I change my route just to greet the kitabe displayed above the Bayezid entrance to the Grand Bazaar or the Kapalı Çarşı, the Çalışan Alanın Sevgi Didir, Sevdikidir, there might be a mispronunciation there here. The one who works hard to learn his livelihood is the beloved slave. which is a nice kitab from a hadith above the place of commerce, one of the main places of commerce in Istanbul. So in exposing themselves to Ottoman places, many people find pleasure also in seasoning their experiences there through the reading of texts of other earlier visitors to them, of which there's an incredibly rich literature in poetry about Istanbul. In canting from this huge archive of poetry and prose about a place while being in that place produces a powerful reorientation towards it. Of course, although beloved poems are read to generate personal connections with places and with poets, poems also possess a wildness and unruliness, often surpassing or contravening the prejudgments of readers. Playing with language and rhythm, poetry reveals a new truth about existing entities, constituting a different version of that object and place, and writing it into existence in such a way that the listener shares and the reader in the creation of its novelty. And also, we can say poetry fosters a rich intersubjectivity with the dead. So we had a memorable afternoon one time sitting in the courtyard of the Atik Valide Mosque in Üsküdar with a group of people. A friend read a poem suddenly by Yahya Kemal about the mosque. We're sitting in the mosque, the poem's about the mosque. It's a longer poem than this one, but it's called Visitation or Visiting. I'll just read out, I won't read the Turkish, but the night we translated this last night, so it may not be, I think other people might have different ways of translating it. In how can we not request mercy for the old architect here, which is Mimar Sinan? In this beautiful landscape, he made water flow from heaven. These walls are worth gazing at for hours. Here and here, he created gardens of tiles that will not fade, and the tiles of that mosque inside the mosque are really noted around Istanbul because they've got a certain color. So here he created gardens of tiles that will not fade. He made such a frame for spiritual comfort that whoever sees it loses themselves in another world. At last, we can say that care for these built environments is a significant practice as well. As are people's educated judgments now about the criticisms of botched alterations and the cheap programs of restorations that local and central governments may be embarking upon. I mean, we're walking around with amateur historians, artists, etc., and it's like walking around with a pack of critics, looking at what the government's done and going, "Oh, look at that terrible thing! How they've restored that there. That they've made a mistake with the lettering, etc." But repair of Istanbul's built environments by councils actually is a practical aspect of this reappraised attitude to Ottoman sites. We can say that this, you know, developed by the Justice and Development Party, the AK Party, in the 2000s, these types of reparative practices have been replicated more recently by the Republic People's Party, the CHP, after their election victory in 2019. The principals of the team, which we joined to have a look at, you know, how what they're doing in around Istanbul and those types of in their repair work. The principals of the team employed by the Istanbul Greater Municipality to mend Ottoman fountains, shrines and tombs, etc., is captured in a fairly strange motto, I would say, of their division: loyalty to a city of damaged history and culture. That's the JAP Council team that whose job is to repair, restore huge numbers of different sort of Ottoman sites over Istanbul's suburbs. Okay, so all these ways of interacting with dynamic and powerful Ottoman entities generate in people lively feelings of shared responsibility for them. But why do people care? Our research suggests that people's present interest in Ottoman things pertains much more to how they contribute to the existential meanings and pleasures of their own lives, and much less to ideological claims that seek to reduce objects' significance to their manifestation of Turkish or Islamic civilizational genius. And this is despite 2 decades of cultural politics by the ruling AK Party government, which obviously in the main directs people's attentions to objects as being some type of revelation of either Islamic or Turkish sort of genius. Indeed, our interlocutor's deepening interest in Ottoman entities has taken place in the historical context of the AK Party's rise to power, including its more recent devolution over the last decade into an authoritarian government shamelessly synthesizing and promoting Turkish nationalism and Islam. Indeed, today, far from being neglected or even demolished, as in an earlier era, the Ottoman Islamic built environment in Istanbul is under tremendous care. AK Party governments have made Ottoman Muslim buildings, particularly mosque complex, integral parts of the city's cultural and spiritual life. Spread throughout the city's older suburbs, AK Party activists value them as ocular reminders of Turkey's magnificent Muslim past, as well as for their architectural theatricality or performativity as appropriate sites to host government-friendly Muslim civil society groups. And yet, we contend that our interlocutor's engagement with Ottoman objects and art practices both disregards and transcends the meanings bestowed on them by the national government and its Directorate of Religious Affairs, the Diyanet. Indeed, one central political issue in Turkey today concerns the contemporary response from below or from the side to the hybrid part populist, part coercive policies of the AK Party. Our recent fieldwork in Istanbul suggests that many people there seek to make their lives differently meaningful through their own alternative engagements with Islam, everyday religious life, with Ottoman art practices, with Republican history, and with the urban environment itself. For us, we think that in developing these interests, many people are ignoring the invitation to situate themselves within the hyperbolic meanings about being Turkish and Muslim provided by an authoritarian and mobilizing AK Party state. And we use that word deliberately, the party state, turning their backs on the charisma of the AK Party's selected political symbols. They foster a different appreciative attitude to the autonomy of Ottoman entities. They take pleasure in objects' material variegations, as well as in crafting new objects with and from them. Particularly, we're looking at the calligraphy workshops and also the music workshops in Istanbul. New works that arise from their training and skilled practices developed by their teachers and by earlier generations of artists through their own exposure to objects. They are energized by their constant discovery that objects possess more withdrawn depths than encapsulated in the relations they have hitherto established with them. Failing to be convinced by the reductive and homogenizing assertions about Ottoman objects' environment by the government, people generate their own significant meanings about ordinary urban living in Istanbul and alternative ways of being a Muslim. Their directing of attentive care to Ottoman entities fosters a different form of ethics and conscience. Okay, for that reason, we contend that these personal and unofficial orientations to the ex-Ottoman city and to Ottoman entities can also be interpreted as practices of an alternative citizenship. One that constitutes a non-AK Party way of expressing one's Muslim life. So in Turkish, the word for citizenship is vatandaşlık, from the root vatan, or nation or homeland, which reverberates with nationalist or nativist overtones. By citizenship, we actually mean much more, of course, than mere membership in a nation state, or even citizens adapting or rejecting of its official identities. Instead, we think that a new word we discovered, we didn't invent it, we discovered yaşamdaşlık, coming from the root life, is a better description of what our interlocutors are doing in their convivial living beside peoples, animals, and objects. So we hope to explore the production of their own citizenly belonging in Istanbul, their experiments in ways of creating solidarity with objects and environments, and their investing of themselves in other types of existential practices. Briefly, what moods and habits characterize this non-conforming citizenship? The literature on citizenship has noted the importance of insurgent citizenship practices that include the explicit challenging of exclusionary citizenship, but it has also noticed more implicitly critical practices, as seen, for example, in the field of arts. Martin Stotz, for example, has written about alternative citizenship in Turkey through the voices of three popular musicians, Zeki Müren, Orhan Gencebay, and Sezen Aksu. And he suggests that each of these figures helped orchestrate sentiments that presented other possible ways of being a Turkish citizen, diverging from the more nationalistic and official versions manufactured by the Turkish state. And I think that similarly, we see in Islamic art practices such as name music, a particular way of becoming a person, a Muslim and a citizen, again, which is opposed to more sort of nationalistic versions. How significant are these minor citizenry practices for Turkish politics? Well, that's a pretty huge question, of course. Crucially, however, we could say for the ideological claims of the AK Party, many Muslims are involved in this fluid evasion of its cultural politics, exploring non-Diyanet ways of living one's socio-religious life. Alpkan and Zeybek note that fundamental to citizenship is the process whereby different groups of citizens enact what they say differential engagements with the law, the state, governments, etc., etc. And we think that in the current period in Istanbul, a period of democratic retrenchment, urban environmental destruction, and huge economic anxiety, our interlocutors are pursuing a different reckoning with the city and its places, attending to and constituting with other, a more merciful Istanbul for themselves. So in brief, our research investigates frictional relations in Istanbul between people's use and constitution of Ottoman things, the AK Party government's own political interested profiling of them, and the ever-present withdrawal from human perception of objects themselves. Because it's pretty clear that Ottoman entities are not exhausted by or reducible to Istanbul people's multiple relations with them. So, in summary, we can say we hope this study is a hybrid experiment in political, existential, and object-oriented anthropology. And in it, we hope that we can trace out and learn various methods of living well, living better, and pursuing new experiences of freedom in Istanbul in the current context. So I think I've still got 5-10 minutes. Is that okay? I'm nearly...
Yeah, if you can, maybe in 5 minutes, if that's possible. Okay. I'm not actually sure exactly when we started, so I don't know, Aydoğan, we can go to 10 minutes.
Okay, good. So we'll just talk briefly about who the people are that we've been working with. Who are these citizens? Over the last few years, we've met and walked around Istanbul with lots of people, men and women, including amateur historians, artists, musicians, government employees, students, etc., etc. Unlike Walton's study, which was done in 2011, actually, of the Neo-Ottoman practices of space generated by two powerful pious foundations that he was doing research with at the time, the Nur and the Gulen communities, none of our interlocutors are members of Muslim jamaats, associations, or political parties. But among themselves, it seems to us, they do share common sensibilities. For example, we observe an approximation of similar educational qualifications among our interlocutors, basically a broad middle classness. Nearly all of them are graduates, caught up in the great boom in tertiary education in Istanbul over the last 30 years, and now working as teachers, administrative musicians, artists, art department graduates, professionals, etc., in different places all over Istanbul. But secondly, we also discern a post-Islamist and a post-nationalist dimension to their practices and to their lives. I would say that having grown up in the main with a sympathetic interest in the new redeemed worlds of Islam generated by the Islamic social movement in Istanbul since the 1990s, our interlocutors now are predisposed to engage with Ottoman Islamic objects, art practices, history, etc., But it does appear to us that nearly all of them are distant from any earlier enthusiastic participation in the fragmented Islamist social movement of the 1990s and 2000s. In fact, jaded with the neoliberal policies of pro-Islamic AK Party governments, their Muslimness is now really differently political than it used to be. When we asked them about what were they doing in the 1990s, were they affiliated with different Islamic things happening in Istanbul in that incredible decade when this unruly, wild Islamic movement, which tried to, the Refah Party tried to get control of and managed to control it after a while, sort of emerged in Istanbul. So we've sort of done a name for them, which we may talk about. We think that we could say they're a dissident fraction of the post-AK Party Muslim middle class. So next question, what's the broader political context of this group of citizens? I'll do this very quickly. The activities of our interlocutors, of course, don't occur in a political and social vacuum. Indeed, for more than a century, Ottoman objects, institutions, and social practices have been at the center of Turkish politics. The Turkish Republic instituted itself through its selective destruction of Ottoman entities, most publicly, of course, of Ottoman cultural, religious institutions and procedures. And throughout its first 50 years in Istanbul, Ottoman sites were routinely neglected and sometimes even demolished in the growth of the city. Of course, how things change. Over the last three decades, the social and political value of Ottoman objects has soared. The ongoing conservation, symbolic resignification, commodification, and use of Istanbul's Ottoman buildings and of Islamic arts by AK Party governments is of central importance. In Istanbul, with such a crowded city, Ottoman madrasas, tekkes, libraries, kitchens, baths, park mansions are invaluable economic and social resources. Restored and divvied out to AK Party-sponsored civil society groups and businesses, AK Party governments at both national and municipal level conserve and redeploy Ottoman objects, and they have developed a highly adaptable discourse about Islam, or Istanbul, Ottoman figures, and historical events, praising for them for their carrying out of national morality, cultural authenticity, and indigenous greatness. No, this is a very high level of abstraction that the AK Party in the main talks about Ottoman history, and a very peculiar historicism in which Islam and the Ottoman period are reconstructed as the hero to the villainy of secular modernity, rather than something complex and diverse in itself. But we're not looking at that, actually. That's the context. We're looking at another group of people. We were seeking to explore how the people in Istanbul bestow their own alternative meanings upon the presence of Ottoman things, resisting in the process these objects' mobilization by the AK Party. The last brief section is to talk briefly about objects themselves. So we can say mercifully, there is a third power in the land. There's the AK Party, there's a dissident faction, let's say, of Muslims, and then there's objects themselves. Beyond people's acceptance or rejection of the AK Party's homogenizing discourse about the significance of Ottoman arts or entities, there is the autonomous existence and forces of the things themselves. Objects are not reducible to their multitudinous features, not only because they appear to perceivers in various perspectives, which is a phenomenological insight, of course, but also because over time their qualities may change. The once pristine grave of Sheikh Hamdullah is the same object despite its present decrepitude. So over the last decade or so, there's been a new object-oriented turn in philosophy, particularly in the work of Graham Harman, but you know, there's that speculative realism movement, which he's a part of. Harman argues that there are two basic types of knowledge about objects, both of which are valuable, but he argues each of which are simultaneously reductive. The first, of course, is the most powerful in our types of societies. It's scientific naturalism, which assumes objects exist independently of human images production, etc., of them. Here, for science, the external world can be known through various scientific procedures, whittling objects down to size by identifying their atomic or chemical structures, or their subcomponents. Matter or materials out there in the world, in nature, wait for their fixed routines or their deeper anonymous forces to be objectively discovered. So Harman calls this mode of knowledge an undermining of objects. By contrast, his second mode of knowledge, the phenomenological, is accused of overmining them. Phenomenology rejects the naturalistic proposition of science that things can be an object of cognition for a person without the event of its cognizing being considered as well. That's the basic point of Husserl's phenomenology, we could say, or the first building block. Phenomenology therefore focuses on how phenomena appear to consciousness, or how consciousness interprets and actively shapes the sensefulness of objects and things. For phenomenology, objects are given meaning by the intentions, the mood, the pragmatic concerns, the political ideologies, let's say the embodied states of human subjects. For phenomenology, people's projects, let's say the governing interests of the AK Party, cause an oriented Ottoman world to arise from sort of the objects in themselves. So for Harman, neither of these modes of knowledge exhaust the reality of objects. He rejects a naturalistic science that maintains things are objectively knowable in themselves by breaking them down into smaller and sort of real parts. And he rejects a phenomenology that accepts that entities are known only in relation to the consciousness of the perceiver. He argues real objects exist beyond human central access to them, possessing unperceived properties even when we direct our attention to them. As he says, and this is a very nice quote, the being of objects are not exhausted by their presence in consciousness. Okay, and we're going to finish up here, but just to say that sound, there's a question therefore about how can people know objects as a form of knowledge. Actually, Harman says knowledge is not the right word that we should be bringing to objects. He asserts that real objects, being unknowable essentially, can only be loved. Actually, he has a few other theories about how through metaphor or through different types of approaches sort of obliquely to objects, there become certain types of not knowledge, but certain types of cognition towards them. So he says objects are unknowable, but they can be loved. And obviously one can love something from afar, but loving something from the proximity is better. So we think that in working with objects and caring for them, people in Istanbul perceive that those objects also welcome them, drawing out of themselves particular actions towards those objects. Objects persistently entreat to people to act towards them in accordance with their own qualities. Softly or forcefully, and we think this partly coming from the way that Islamic artists, if they're working with ink, or if they're working with reeds, or if they're working with materials, that those, the substance and the independence of those materials actually insist on a certain type of just response action towards them. People's embodied responses to the behavioral instigations of objects and environments are not individually personal, because there's something coming from the object. But they're also not party political, as if we do whatever the AK Party thinks, tells us what's the meaning of things. So I'll just jump to the conclusion, because I know we don't want to go have some discussion maybe. So in short, there's more to say on object-oriented ontology, which is sort of a way that we want to make a mediating bridge between objects themselves and the various types of approaches to them that different people are taking. But we conclude by saying Ottoman objects, Ottoman environments, and the embodied practices and interactions historically instigated by them. These Ottoman objects radiate energy and affect, channeling people's and other living beings' engagement with them. Over and above the intentions of their builders materialized in them, Ayazma Jami's bird boxes themselves negotiate with the bodies and the activities of avian actors. Here we can say what's important is the autonomous existence of Ottoman objects. With their inexhaustibility of meaningness and a stubbornness of agency, the people engaged with them receive from them. Objects are not reducible to the intentions of those who made them. They're not reducible to the educated or uneducated perceptions of those who constitute and then engage with them. And they're not reducible to the politicized discourse of those who control them. And they're not reducible to their use by humans as well. So we would argue that objects are more than a resource for satisfying our desires, whether that's political, social, or something else, existential. Like a poem, perhaps, their powerful agency and autonomous being apart from perceptual consciousness of them transcends the ideological projects of those in the present who are currently powerfully seeking to enlist them in political discourse. Thank you.